are listening to the INCJ podcast, Conversations about International Criminal Justice.
Hello, welcome to the INCJ Quickfire News Desk. We're streaming out on YouTube at the moment, and so you can see all the background work and activity of saying hello to people and connecting people and getting microphones working and things like that in the background on the YouTube. But for our next contributor is, I'm really pleased to introduce Brian Hogan, who works with an organisation or supports an organisation, Relationships at Work. And you're going to be looking at the idea of how connection, communication and trust influence the experience of practitioners and people who support people in the criminal justice system. Is that general overview?
Absolutely, yeah.
Brilliant. Okay, if you give it, give us a quick overview, we'll listen in and we'll drop back in for some thoughts and some discussion with you as soon as you run through what you do and how you're working on things.
Okay, guys. So the what I'm doing currently is inextricably linked to what I've been doing for the last 36 years. So in 1989, I started working in Warrenstown House here in Ireland, which was a child psychiatric unit. And I was there for 2 years. And then I moved in 1991 out to Oberstown Boys School, which was a reformatory school at the time in North County Dublin. And I was there working in direct care on the floor from 1991 to 96, a unit manager from 96 to 99, deputy director from 1990 to 2002, and director from 2002 to 2013. When I went for 5 years then on secondment as CEO out into mainstream care in the community, out to Don Bosco Care, back to the Oberstown campus in 2018 to a much expanded Oberstown campus, the single detention facility in the Republic of Ireland for under 18-year-olds. And I was there as Deputy Director of Operations until 2025, just March of this year, when after 36 years, I finished with the public sector. One of the things I wanted to say was, what is the difference? How have things changed from 1989 or 1991 to 2025? And one of the remarkable things in my career was the number of children, as in young people under the age of 18, who have taken somebody else's life, who currently are in custody. When I started working in 1991, a young person who had taken somebody else's life, a child who had taken somebody else's life, would come into the system every 5 or 6 years. And it would usually be a set of very unusual circumstances, often family related, and almost always somebody who was known to the child. To fast forward to the last 3 or 4 years, there's been a dramatic change. Even before that, of course, and all of you are involved in this area will know this, in terms of drug use, drug sales, gang control of drugs, and the grooming of kids, of children, even very young children, into that whole area of crime, of selling for the drug gangs, of using themselves, and of drug debt. So maybe 3 or 4 years ago, in the Republic of Ireland, over 50% of young people that were in custody, over 50% of children that were in custody had taken somebody else's life. That's one point. And that point for me speaks to the complexity of the work of frontline workers, of middle managers, and of senior leaders. One of my other hats at the moment is I'm a member of the board of the Consortium for Therapeutic Communities based in the UK. And I'm really enjoying that and enjoying my interaction with colleagues who are working working across therapeutic communities, across the prison estate, and across the children's network. One piece. The second thing, building on what Abigail has been talking about and talking about relational care. When I started working, I probably started long before Abigail started. But likewise, our systems were behaviour modification. I believed that I was the adult, I was right, the person who were in my custody, people who were in my custody, or person indeed, were wrong, and that they needed to do exactly what I told them to do when I told them to do it. I wasn't long being disabused of that view, often by a box in the jaw. The thing is, I began to realise that other human beings will simply not do something just because I told them to, or because I said they were to. I suppose the next piece I would say is my own journey of learning in terms of relational care, and Abigail talking about boundaries in relational care, and also talking about how we can speak to a wider world about why. And one of the questions that have been asked in the previous hour is why should we be decent? Why should we be human? Why should we be kind? Why should we relate in a warm way to people who have committed very, very serious offences? And my short, witty answer to that is because it works. My example of that is in 1996, around about July or August 1996, I was working one evening in one of the units on the floor at that stage. I think just about to start as a unit manager, but a few months off promotion. And I was working with a young person who had a horrific history of trauma. And the only reason I knew about the trauma is we had a shared interest, which is another key point in all of this. Both of us loved cars, and I still love cars. So that was our point. And back then, because of a different system, I could take him out into a yard and I could let him wash a car that belonged to the organization, or even back then wash my own car. And while he was washing the car, we'd have a conversation. And he was excellent, absolutely excellent at doing cars. So when he didn't have to look me straight in the eye, when he didn't have to sit across me across the table, or when I wasn't in a confrontational position with him, he would talk. And he would talk about his life and his background and his history. His dad was alcoholic, extremely violent. They lived in a rural part of Ireland here. His mum, to get a little bit of respite, would check herself in to a secure psychiatric hospital just to get respite from her life. I also, over the years, knew many of the rest of his family. I knew his brothers, who one after the other, year after year, came into custody. So one evening, this particular kid, wasn't allowed into the kitchen area in the unit because he had previously taken knives and forks and utensils and harmed other people with it. But he walked into the kitchen. Often, those of you that are familiar with the custodial setting will know that human error can be our enemy sometimes. So a colleague had inadvertently left the kitchen door open. He got in. I followed him in. And because I had a relationship with him, I said, I can use his first name. It's many, many years ago. It's a common enough name. I said to him, Martin, you know you're not allowed in the kitchen. He reacted to this completely with anger. And he took a knife, and I moved away from him and the knife back out into the main area, and he ended up holding the knife to my throat for a period of maybe 15, 20 minutes. And long time, hugely long time. So again, in terms of scanning the room, I'm looking around the room, I'm looking for who else is in the room, what colleagues are there, what help I might get. I'm gradually and slowly trying to work the knife away from the most dangerous part of my neck. And I'm in survival mode. I'm thinking about how I'm going to survive here. And one of the factors that I hadn't thought of was the help that I might get from other young people. So when there was another young person in the room, a young person that I'd connected with, that I had been kind to and shown some kindness to. And the other young person began to say to Martin, that's Brian Hogan. That's Brian Hogan. That's Brian Hogan. The young person, almost instinctively, was doing exactly what we would now train people to do in hostage situations. Humanize the person that's been held, humanize the potential victim. After a few minutes, Martin exited with his dignity by throwing the knife away into a corner of the room and storming back into the kitchen, at which point my colleagues could intervene. I could be got safely out of the situation. We could move on. Why do I tell you this Thursday afternoon? I tell you this because, as an example of how I believe relational care works. If I hadn't got the, and in this case, it wasn't even the relationship with Martin that was the key factor. It was my relationship with the other young person, and that I'd connected with the other young person. So jumping back to young people who take other people's lives and why we would be kind to them. So first and foremost, one of the things that's helped me most, and I realize I'm speaking very much about the children's sector, speaking about the juvenile estate, but one of the things that's helped me most is to first always conceptualize that this individual that's beside me or in front of me as a child, first of all. Exactly what Abigail was saying. You go back to people's history, hurt people. That the experiences that some of the young people that are in custody have had is absolutely astounding. Most of us would not have survived it at all, simply would not have made it. So they've had to be very, very much in survival mode for most of, if not all, of their lives. They've developed a system that works for them. And sometimes the system is no longer fit for purpose. It's no longer useful. It's not purposeful. It's illegal a lot of time. People that I've come across whose coping system is, first of all, to reject, to shout, to be more violent, if possible, than the potential violence that they see in another. So hit out at other people, scream and roar. It takes time and a lot of relational connection to work on diminishing this and getting young people to form a new way of operating, a new way of working. Okay, onwards to what do I do now? So after 36 years, I came out of the criminal justice system, came out of the public sector. I retired for about 2 weeks and realized that I'm not done with social care. I'm not done with relational care. And I'm not done particularly with the, I suppose, satisfaction, the sense of deep satisfaction that I get through connecting with other people, connecting with staff teams, looking at the development of staff teams. One of the things that sustained me through my leadership journey in the area of secure care was supervision, mentorship. In 2002, I connected with a group analyst and psychotherapist to do my supervision, a guy called Graham Farquharson. And for 13 years, I met Graham one day a month. And I offloaded all the stuff, all the angst, all the people who had killed other people, all the people who had raped other people, all of my staff teams mirroring behaviours in this area. Because one of the other pieces that I've absolutely come across from my own work is how all the hurt that we're absorbing from the young people in custody is affecting us also and is coming down on us, particularly frontline staff. From the simplest thing of just hearing about the terrible things that these young people have done, that these human beings, the things that these human beings have had inflicted today on them and the things that they in turn have inflicted on other people. That has an abrasive effect on staff. Staff offload this onto a manager, manager onto a senior manager, and the senior managers then funnel it and channel it right up that to the senior leader in the organization who absorbs all this and has to hold all this. All this hurt, all this angst. Very interesting in a secure environment as well is even ancillary teams, teams working in household, teams working in catering, they also reflect this hurt and this angst. And sometimes they perceive slights and difficulties, interpersonal stuff from their own team members, even in ancillary areas that may not really be there. And I believe firmly that this is a symptom of working in a secure environment surrounded all by all this hurt and trauma. So what do I do now? Back to that. So again, like Abigail says about their website, there's a website up there, www.relationships-at-work.ie. So I'm working with teams across residential care. I work with a colleague largely, and we have a big piece of work on for 2026 with one organisation in fostering resilience and team development across probably 12 residential facilities. I also do some work with senior leaders right around the world, which is wonderful for me. That's the beauty of Zoom. I only learned Zoom during COVID-19. I barely knew it existed before that. doing some work there, doing some expert witness stuff. And we're also doing some online training in relational care, in de-escalation, in risk management, in really, I suppose, trying to impart what we've learned during our careers, but also to learn from the people, from the participants in a group. So we're very much an informal workshop style. I'm enjoying doing it. And I'm just really glad now to have the freedom to do work that's interesting and work that I feel will make an impact and is making an impact to people. I work largely through story. I've spoken at the Fivaca conference there in the UK this year. I've spoken at the TCTC conference. And we're absolutely honoured to have been accepted to do a 90 minute in Newfoundland at the CYC World Conference this year. It's a real, real highlight for me. And of course, I mentioned TCTC there, the Consortium for Therapeutic Communities. Graham, that I mentioned, had been a former director himself of Pepper Harrow Therapeutic Community there in the UK many, many years ago. And it's a lovely circle for me to now be a board member of TCTC, the Consortium for Therapeutic Communities, and started to close that circle and come back around to that. So as I say, I operate very much through the medium of story and lots of other stories, but I'm conscious of the time and I'm conscious that people want to ask me something or lead me in a different direction. I'm very happy to do that as well.
That was wonderful. Thank you, Brian. That was a really invigorating overview. And if colleagues have got questions and I want to drop in, that'd be great. I suppose the question I've got is, a lot of what we do is kind of we're pushing back against the over-individualization of these things and we're stepping back to look at things collectively. So when you describe the projection from, the angst, animosity, whatever's wrong with an individual that's led them to the route where violence is their expression and that dysfunction. But that has a ripple effect through the organization. And if the organization isn't set up where they've got the responsibility for managing and caring or whatever it is that they're there to do, that's going to get disrupted by that. And we don't think about that holistically. We tend to look at it as purely as an individual.
Well, absolutely. And that's one of the reasons, Rob, why I mentioned restorative practice, even in the stuff I sent you originally. Because the thing is, for an organization, for me to ask a frontline member of staff to behave in a restorative way towards a troubled young person, and then for me to permit a unit manager, a middle manager, a senior manager to shout and roar at a member of staff and not work in a restorative way, is rupturing that in the organization. Absolutely. The organization needs to be set up as a holding environment. First of all, leaders in an organization, all across senior management teams, need to realize that this is the case. And not to be surprised when hurt people behave in a hurtful way. And to accept and understand, I often used to say to people, and I was just listening about the prisons in Norway and about some of the excellent comments around, they probably had a growth and they probably weren't perfect from the start. So one of the things, we have a child rights based system here in Ireland, but one of the things I always said to people when they were coming to visit me is we are not perfect. And any organisation that any of us visit where a director or a governor tells you that they have no drugs, they have no incidents of violence, they have no physical restraint, in my view, and I can say this now as a retiree, that governor or that director is either lying to you or delusional, or they just don't know what's going on in their own organisation. Because it's not possible to manage disturbance without having some areas of disturbance. It's just going to happen. It's as simple as that. The question is just as an organisation and as a manager, what do you do about it and what do you do with it? Recognising it is the first thing. I mean, a key piece is reflective practice. And I was very interested in listening to Abigail talking about correctional staff engaging in reflective practice. Really, really, really important for people to think out what's happening for them and to discuss it with a colleague, for people to continue in learning. I mean, one of the big things here in Ireland, just closed there on the 30th of November, is social care workers is now a protected title. So people who are working are registered now. They're registered as a social care worker and they're required to engage in continuous professional development. Key piece of that is definitely reflective practice and high quality supervision, the idea of clinical supervision, talking things out and surfacing things. Again, using the restorative questions, continuing with the relational practice in supervision as well. Totally agree with previous speakers. Blame and shame simply does not work. Shame is the one emotion that will stick with us for time and time and time and time. People who have humiliated us, even myself, my own pet hate is somebody scoffing or laughing at me behind my back. Say it to my face. If you disagree with me, you disagree with me. If you think I'm talking horse rubbish, tell me, rather than scoff or laugh. You know, I think that's the most destructive thing for people.
Let's bring Dave wants to as raise a hand. Let's have a what you thought, Dave.
That was really powerful, Brian, and to tell the story about your own experience was a very brave thing to do. So one doesn't know really how to respond in that to that. But I just come from a meeting. That's why I've been late joining. Of people involved in the probation service in England and Wales. And it wasn't the topic of the meeting, but it was one of the issues that emerged. Was it a few days ago, a trainee probation officer was assaulted and stabbed in England. In Oxford, in fact, it's the first time I'd heard about it. It apparently made big headlines in the Sun with the kind of lurid kind of headline that you might expect. But what struck me was that, and I looked around at reactions to this. Was that the paradigm that people were now were working from or using to address the problem was a health and safety paradigm, one which was the opposite of what you were talking about. It was one which was focused entirely on the victim. And how to prevent such victimization in the future, which is clearly an imperative and shouldn't be understated. But that seems so different to your approach, which was, well, yes, there's that on one side of the equation, but restorative practice is essential for preventing re-victimization and indeed and desistance in relation to the perpetrator. So I just and the health and safety paradigm seemed to me, well, that's where we are these days. Yeah. Everything is being turned into procedures and health and if it's a health and safety issue, it can be conceptualized as a set of procedures can be set up, not least increasing the amount of barrier between probation officers and their clients. I just wonder what your reaction would be.
Yeah. So first of all, I hadn't heard about the stabbing of the trainee probation officer in the UK as well. And I do scan for news like that. So I'm very sorry for the person. God help him or her. It's particularly for a trainee, it's a very difficult start to career. So what I would say is risk management, health and safety, safety in general, and high quality relational practice or relational care are not mutually exclusive. You can approach the safety piece very much with your restorative and relational hat on. But what we want to avoid, which you're very much hitting on there, Dave, is further barriers that from now on probation officers will only be allowed to meet clients in offices and they'll have to sit behind screens. That won't work at all. Absolutely won't work at all. But what we can, so I suppose, for my management, I suppose in the detention area, I would say to colleagues, even a colleague who had been hurt, I can't promise you that you'll never be assaulted. It's not a fair promise for me to give you. We work with people who have experienced extreme trauma, and from time to time they will strike out. What we can do is we can put a set of sensible, researched through action research, or we can use the word experience, measures in place. Some of which are very, very, very simple. And the other thing we can do is we can train you. And I've just used the word train there. And I was at an event yesterday where I felt I was being trained, and I resented it all night last night. The fact that I've been trained like a monkey. But develop skills in people, I would prefer to say, where we can say to somebody, if this was to happen, this is the best advice I can give you as to how to handle it. One of the things I learned as a young 20-something male in an environment was my original approach would have been, when somebody was screaming and shouting and roaring at me, to scream and shout and roar back louder and to get further into their face. Absolutely not. One of the things I discovered where somebody is very angry and aggressive towards me is if I move to the other side of the room and if I sit down, particularly as a male, a younger male, make myself in a vulnerable position and put my hands out, show myself as a non-threat. I mean, stuff like how to speak, the sort of language we're using, realizing that the person who is currently a threat to you may have a very limited language register. And I'm only annoying them further if I use words like language register when I'm communicating with them. So there are a series of practical techniques. There, of course, are things like remaining connected with your colleagues. You don't need to be carrying radios and cameras and things like that. If I'm going out to meet somebody, I can simply say to you, Dave, if I don't ring you by 3:30 or text you by 3:30, send the cavalry, send the police, because I'm in trouble, because I will contact you. And there are ways even to do that in terms of continuing in a relational way with the person you're working with. You can simply say to the person, oh my God, I forgot to ring Dave. You don't have to say for what reason. All you need to say to them is, I need to remind him of something. There's also very much the therapeutic use of humour and stuff, and how you can say, oh, I'm getting very old now. I'm inclined to forget to ring Dave and I'm supposed to ring him. Wait till I do this properly now. There's also, I've used in my later career, I've used things like, of course I'm not going to be able to overpower you. I'm an old fella and I'm overweight. And, you know, so to use things like that, but to use humour. Humour should always be against yourself rather than against anybody else. Anyway, there's lots of sort of practical things like that. But the other thing I feel is, and the importance of the likes of this network, is in the world that we're in now, where absolutely the script comes from the Sun, or it comes from the Daily Mail, or it comes from leaders, world leaders, who just want to ban everything and throw everybody out and lock everybody up, and where they're getting kudos from bombing things and killing things, and legality has become a very, very, very dubious thing in some, you know, and human rights and civil rights, and I could go on for a long time. But we have a responsibility to try and gently advance a different way and a different script. And sometimes we need to absolutely pay respect to the health and safety at the beginning, but explain that on its own, and certainly barrier systems, stopping and excluding and removing human contact, simply won't work. Big long answer.
No, that was great. We're up against time, so I'm going to say thank you very much, Brian. That was amazing. We will follow up, because I think there's a longer conversation and discussion to be had about this. And that's the great thing about doing the news desk like this, is that it's a taster, and I think we'll definitely follow up. So
thank you so much for the story, Brian.
Really, really good to meet you. And do you know what? When you were speaking, I was thinking about, from you, from your Chinese culture, how far apart we are geographically and in terms of air miles, and how closely the problems mirror one another. How human beings worldwide have such a similarity.
Yeah. If I can just have 30 seconds, just want to respond to Brian's. I think what you're saying and what you're doing in terms of relationship and realizing the holistic support that's needed ripples beyond criminal justice in universities, in schools. We're seeing more violent, more aggressive incidents. My former colleague that I worked with in Shanghai, he was punched by a PhD student and he had a concussion of it. And I've been reported by students as well on more than one occasion. So how do you face that without saying, oh, I'm just not going to trust any students anymore. I'm just going to try to not have interactions. That's the first response probably, but then we need to move beyond that and find a more better way forward.
Wonderful.
Thank you very
much. Thank you very much. We'll bring in our next speaker, but we'll follow up and the information I'll put on the website.
You have been listening to the INCJ podcast, Conversations about International Criminal Justice. To find out more, go to our website at criminaljusticenetwork.net or follow us on Twitter at INTCJ Network.